What really gets my dick hard is...
So fucking what?
Welcome to Metal Up Your Podcast. I'm Ethan Luck.
And I'm Clint Wells.
And we're at episode number 39. We hope you enjoyed the Reload episode last week. And this week, this is kind of a treat for everyone, I think, especially Clint and I. We've saved the best for last as far as current Metallica members go. And we're going to be talking about Mr. James Hetfield in this episode.
Our dude, man. He's our homie.
He is, man.
One of my all-time favorite songwriters, one of my all-time favorite guitar players.
Absolutely.
And kind of just an all-around fascinating, interesting cat.
And a total badass, let's be honest.
That's just a badass, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Hetfield can do no wrong in our eyes. We're obviously both giant fans of him, and like Clint said, as a songwriter and stuff. So yeah, this was a very fun episode to kind of prepare for. You know, even going through like notes and facts and stuff, it's all these things I already knew and kind of learning a couple other new things about James. So yeah, I'm excited to get into it. But before that, we got to get to see the housekeeping stuff.
Yeah, we'll get through this stuff pretty quick because we're both excited to talk about James. So the main thing we want to say is we have a Patreon account. If you don't know what that is, it's a way for you to support the show. We have all sorts of different tiers of different incentives and different ways that you can give back. The most important thing that you can get from the Patreon is Ethan and I are recording a Metallica covers EP that's exclusively only being put out through Patreon. So go to patreon.com/metalupyourpodcast to learn more about it. We got new patrons this week, and I want to give them a shout out, if I may. Can I?
You have my permission.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Our new patrons this week are Bad Wobot, Jerry D. Cody, and then longtime friend of the show, Gene Froman.
Yeah, Gene.
And I wanted to highlight Gene because Gene reached out and said, hey, I want to support the show, but for whatever reason, and other people have done this too, she kind of wanted to bypass the rigmarole of Patreon. So she just PayPal'd us a year's worth of Patreon support. So
yeah,
you can
very,
do that if you
nice.
Want. So I just wanted to say thanks to our patrons. We have t-shirts and we have patches and stickers. We have all this cool stuff that would not be possible without the support of those patrons. So
that's right.
So that's that. You ready to rock some email?
I think it's time for emails. Our first email is from Patrick. Patrick says, hey dudes, the Reload episode was great. The most important thing that I prefer is the end songs Outlaw Torn and Fixer over Struggle, Damage, Inc., and Dire's Eve. And that's pretty much why I love the loads. Why I love the loads.
Love the load.
Gotta love the loads. Because those records speak to me on a different level than the rest. Might be because I'm young, 25. I got early into the loads. Man, sometimes you gotta get into the loads early.
Yeah, for sure.
He says, hopefully we'll see more songs from those records played live someday. I hope so too, man.
Thanks, Patrick from Sweden!
Patrick from Sweden.
From Sweden! Neil Hansen writes, Reload was dead last in my album rankings, but mostly it's pretty solid. So this happened a lot. So people ranked it low, kind of like you did, Ethan.
Yeah,
but still think it's a good record. So I appreciate that. He says, it's Slither, Attitude, and Prince Charming that really dragged this one down for me. Those are pretty much the first Metallica songs I considered filler. The God That Failed would probably be one too, but nothing on Load. I gave them plenty of chances when the album came out, but since iPods, etc. have been around, none of those three have made it to any of my devices. I had 10 years of listening to them, so I don't think checking them out again would change my mind. All right, fair enough.
Fair.
That's fine. All right. Well, I got to disagree with you about The God That Failed. But
yeah, me too, man.
But thanks
we'll
for talking,
Neil. Yeah, and we'll talk about that song specifically on this James episode, because, you'll hear about it in a bit.
All right.
All right, next email is from Dylan McIntyre. Hey, guys, great Reload episode. Happy to see that there are fans of this era of the boys. Although I like Load much better, there are some awesome tunes on this record, especially the first four and the last three. Fixer is my favorite from the record, and I can't wait to hear Clint's full version on the EP. Well, I've heard the full version. It's fucking awesome. Keep up the great work. P.S. I got my shirt. Fucking awesome.
Cool, man.
Awesome, Dylan. We'll wear it loud and proud, dude.
If you guys want a t-shirt, by the way, we're almost out of our first batch. We're going to make more, and I think the next batch might even be a little different. But if you do want a t-shirt, email us, metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com with your address and the size you want. They're $20. That includes shipping. And I throw in some stickers and shit. Literal shit I throw in there also.
Yeah, loads.
So that's the deal with the t-shirts. Thanks, Dylan. Our friend Tony Tombi, who we have now dubbed Tony Timbali.
If only he had like a little theme song to go with his email.
Hmm. Hold on a second. All right. He writes, "Hi guys, I'm similar to Ethan in that I came on board during Justice. Puppets is my favorite of their albums, and I'd put Load Reload at 8 to 9 of my top 10. I've been a musician for 25 years now, and so I appreciate that they tried to evolve during the Load Reload era. Every time I come back to these albums, I just think they're very mediocre. Not horrible, but not nearly what Metallica have been capable of before, and thankfully with Death Magnetic and Hardwired afterwards. They're my boys, so I've always stuck with them, and the fact that they don't sit idly by just churning out the same albums like other bands is good. I also understand where Clint's coming from, since he has sentimental attachment to these albums. Thanks again for the show, Tony."
Tony Timbali. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
I don't know how you can convince someone to dive into Load and Reload even more and try to like them more. You can't, I guess, really force that upon somebody. But I don't know. I kind of wrote those records off for a long time and dove back in.
And I might even some small ways be doing that with Saint Anger right now. But my thing is, too, is like my real beef is with people that haven't checked it out.
Right.
I mean, shit, if you check it out and you don't like it, that's cool.
Yeah, totally.
That's cool in the gang. No problem. It's just the people who are like, "I listened to it one time 2,000 years ago.
And it was stupid.
And it sucks. Reload sucks.
Reload sucks."
But I hear you, Tony. He's saying he's checked it out and you know, it's not his flavor. That's fine. That's cool.
That's fine. Well, thanks for the email, Tony. Moving on here, our next email is from Brett Holcomb. He says, "Hey, guys, love the podcast and always listen while I'm running. I got to say my Saint Anger 2 cents in before you guys do the episode. I became a Met fan in 1998 when a buddy let me listen to the Black album. Then I became obsessed and bought every album. Saint Anger was the first original studio album to come out that I was able to buy the day of release. Yes, I noticed the snare and no solo problems immediately, but I was blown away at they were back to metal. Say what you will about the album, but it is metal and it has thrashy parts in it. I love the loads. I love people were calling them the loads. I love the loads, but when I hear this, I thought now they're metal again and they can improve on this. And they did. Anyway, Saint Anger holds a special place in my heart for nostalgia's sake. I listened to that album a lot back in the day. Anyways, thanks for reading." Well, Brett, you're welcome. And, I like what you're doing. I like that you came in on this record and it was the first one you could purchase on the release day. I'm going to have to disagree with some of your thoughts about it, but that's fine. I mean,
it is a common argument though, that they're like, "Oh, it was them getting back to thrash." I don't hear that.
I mean, I think there's parts of it on there where it gets like super fast and heavy and stuff. And I think there's thrash elements in there. But, you know, like Clint said, right now, we're kind of slowly diving back into that record in preparation to do a Saint Anger episode. So, I mean, maybe there's some points that Brett makes that I'll end up agreeing with. Who knows?
Well, the very minimum, we appreciate you, Brett, for writing in and letting us know what you think about that shit.
That's right.
Tom O'Neill writes, "Hey there, I've only discovered Metal Up Your Podcast a week ago, starting with episode 1 and working straight through, and I've just started episode 21. So for the last week, I've mostly been listening to you or when I'm not doing my homework by studying the albums and stuff you're going to review. All right, cool." He says, "I have only gotten back into Metallica because of the podcast." Wow. I think it's fantastic. That's pretty cool. Actually, that's a great compliment. That's one of the highest compliments we can get.
Yeah.
He says, "I think it's fantastic. You guys have a great level of knowledge and are very interesting. I think Torben is awesome. And as a big Megadeth fan, too, I'm glad Torben now has a friend in Dave."
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to hear his compliments.
Hello, Tom. Although that joke may now have gone away as though I... He's saying he has 20 episodes to listen to. Nope, it's still here.
Yeah.
Much to the chagrin of some of our listeners, Dave is here. Hello, listeners.
Hello there, Dave. David.
He says, "Based on your reviews, I've gone on to listen to Hardwired, and I'm loving it. I'm still not a huge fan of Death Magnetic, and I still hate Saint Anger, but thanks for reigniting my love of a band I had left behind. Great work." Well, it's shocking that you don't like Death Magnetic, but that's all right.
That's all right. I mean, hey, keep diving back into that record. I mean, that's, I don't know. I think for me, coming off of Saint Anger, when I heard Death Magnetic, I'm like, okay, it doesn't sound great, but it's still a really cool record. And there's a lot of great material on there.
Yeah, and I was just so excited because it just seemed like they were back. That was my big takeaway, was my boys are back. They're back.
Totally. I love it. Well, Tom from Northern Ireland, thank you so much for the email. And as we all know, Northern Ireland is in New Jersey.
Of course.
So hope the weather's all right up there in New Jersey. Yep. Next email is from Mike Lane. He says, hey, guys, you have a great podcast, and thanks especially for the Chris Cornell episode. Cornell's death was sticking with me for a while, same here, and I knew why, due to various reasons, symbolic loss of youth, how sudden it was, no more new music, his talent, his family, etc. There was something else nagging me about it, and I couldn't figure out why until I heard your podcast. When y'all started talking about how long he's been in our lives, that's what nailed it. I'm 40 and I've been listening to Cornell since I was 15. His music has been in my life for 25 years and now he's gone. 25 years is a long time to have someone in my life, especially at such a formative period of my life. He goes on to say, I was introduced to his music at such a formative age and witnessed his rise to superstardom and then as an elder, but still relevant rock statesman. He ends by saying, I wasn't just able to do that with someone like Greg Allman or David Bowie just due to my age. So thanks for helping me get through all of this. I'm still sad, but the sadness decreases as time goes on. Well, I agree. Just like Mike here, that was an artist that I've been listening to that long, and it heavily affected me, more so than other people that have passed away that I'm fans of.
Yeah, me too. The Chris and Prince were two really big ones for me. I got to say to you guys out there who are still bummed and still miss Chris and all that, a record that has really been helping me, and it's a record Ethan turned me on to, I didn't even know it existed, is Chris Cornell's last solo record. It's called Higher Truth.
It's great.
And it's a sad record because you can hear, like, his death makes a little sense when you hear the record, you know, because he was kind of writing about what he was struggling with. Yep. But it's just so beautiful and so amazingly well written, and of course he sings like a fucking angel.
Yep.
I recommend going and don't listen to it on Spotify, don't watch it on YouTube, go buy the goddamn record and live with it.
It is fantastic. It's such a good record.
Thanks, Mike. I'm glad that episode could help you, bud. That's cool.
Yeah, man, me too.
Nicole Williams writes, hi guys, I'm not afraid to admit when I'm wrong. After the Philly show, I voiced my approval of the drum circle. However, after my fourth show this summer, the novelty had worn off, and I was pretty bored with that part of the show. Now that that nonsense nearly killed Papa Het, they really need to go. Off to listen to Reload. So what she's referring to is in Amsterdam a few nights ago, James, during the Now That We're Dead segment, these four slots in the stage. Have you seen this, Ethan?
Yeah, it's crazy, yeah.
The four slots in the stage opened so the drums can come up, and James took a pretty intense fall into one of them.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And I can only imagine that, like, you know, of course he knew about it. He was warned about it, all that stuff. But in the heat of the moment, adrenaline's going, middle of the show, you just blank and all of a sudden down he goes.
Well, it's weird because it looks to me like they don't even have any like gaff tape, you know, like glow in the dark. I mean, they're all pros. They know what they're doing, but it looked pretty dangerous to me.
Yeah, it definitely did. I'm
and
sure.
The fall looked pretty hard. If you look at it from one of the angles, he fell kind of into the side of it, and his guitar kind of took a lot of the hit, but
yeah,
he probably would have broken a rib if his guitar hadn't been in between him and that thing.
Yeah, I mean, a fall like that is no joke, especially when you're not prepared for it to brace yourself at all. It's just like 100% of your body weight just crashing down. But we're glad Hetfield's fine. I mean, he got up like a champ and then like the badass that he is and continued the show, and he looked in a little bit of pain, but...
Yeah, he did. He made a good joke because... He was like, I'm okay. He's like, it just hurt my feelings.
Oh, James is a comedian too, see?
Yeah, Nicole, I'm also surprised that they carried that drum thing into the arena shows. I agree. It's kind of a snooze part of the show.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. I'm sure when they started doing the arena thing, Lars was like, hey, by the way, we're doing the drum thing still. And they're like, oh, God.
James is like, but I'm going to fall into this goddamn trap door and fall into hell and
he's
kill
like, no,
myself.
You won't. You'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Nah, you'll be fine. Nah, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, cool. Nicole, thank you for writing in. Our next email is from Vincent Monroe. He says, what's up, brothers? Met Up Your Podcast is therapy, and I felt the urge to check in and say a heartfelt thank you for covering Reload on the podcast this past week. Reload was my first new Metallica record, and I came on board during that heavy promo on MTV for Load a year earlier.
Yeah, that was called the Mother Load. It was awesome.
The Mother Load. Yeah, it was really cool.
It was so fun.
If you don't know what that is, go find it on YouTube or whatever. And there might even be stuff on Metallica.com about it.
Yeah.
It was such a cool contest thing they were doing.
Yep.
He says, I vividly remember waiting outside my local record store for the clerk to open the doors, sprinting in and snatching a copy off the shelf of the on release day. This record had a special place in my heart and has been there for me during some tough times in my life. Fixer has to be my medicine. Fixer has been my medicine since Monday's podcast. Of course, the tough things in life will always be there waiting, but having a song with lyrics like this to help people through hard times is nothing short of a miracle. Excuse me. Ends by saying, thank you guys for diving deep into these records and highlighting the lyrics especially. You helped make my week a lot better. Well, Vinny, we're happy to do it here. I mean, that's what we're here for.
Thanks, Vinny. Vinny's a patron of the show, too, by the way. Long-time friend of the show.
Thank you.
Blair Tom, this is our last email, by the way.
They're doing too many emails.
It's taking too long.
I want to hear about Hetfield Honey.
Reload sucks.
Blair Tom says, hey, Clint and Ethan. Blair here from Saskatchewan, Canada. He says, I explained last time writing in that my first taste of Metallica was age 13 when my brother, who passed away in 2001, showed me the song Fuel, and I proceeded to steal Reload from his car. I remember that. Remember that email? I remember
that, dude. Yeah, definitely.
He says, this album will always be special to me, and I still have the CD to this day that I stole 18 years ago. He sent us a picture of it in the email.
Yeah.
He says, keep up the awesome work on the podcast. Look forward to it every single week. Each time I listen to the podcast, I listen to more Metallica, and it brings me back to great memories of my big brother that I looked up to so much as a kid. There are truly no words I could say to you guys that would represent my full appreciation for what you're doing. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Man, thank you, Blair.
Thank you so much, Blair.
It's cool, man. Music's powerful. For some people, music is like going to the movies or like going to see a football game. It's just sort of casual entertainment. But there are people out there, I'm one of them, you're one of them, Blair's one of them, where music is way much more than that. I mean, like Vinny said in the previous email, he said it was a miracle, you know, how this music's getting him through a tough time. And
yeah, I mean, I've been there, dude. I mean, I've had, you know, friends pass away, this and that, relatives, and, you know, besides my wife, it's the first thing I turn to.
For sure. I mean, I would even, as cheesy as it sounds, I mean, I would say that it's probably saved my life in many ways.
Absolutely, yeah.
So thanks, dudes. I'm really glad to be a part of that in small and large ways, however that shapes out. You ready to talk about James Hetfield?
Duh.
Nah, let's just call it a day.
Yeah, okay, that's been episode 39,
thanks, guys.
Peace.
Adios.
Yeah, we switched our outro tag.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Hetfield. Let's get in some facts about Mr. James Allen Hetfield. What do you say?
Yeah, I'm in.
All right, so we got James Allen Hetfield. That's his full name. He was born in Downey, California, August 3rd, 1963. Papa Het's 54 years old, and he's still out there making some great fucking music and killing it live.
Yeah, he's looking great, man.
Not a lot. I mean, there's not a lot of dudes, especially in the metal genre, when they get to that age that can really hang anymore, you know?
Yeah, and it's good to see him like going strong. It makes me excited about the next 10 years, the next 15 years of that band.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, just him having been sober for so long now and having just such a different outlook on life is all reflecting in their music, and I just love it.
Yeah, and I got to say, I mean, we'll dive into this a little later, but I liked the sort of badass, scary 90s James. That flavor was really fun when I was a kid.
Course.
But he didn't seem as likable as this, you know, as the James we've had over the last 15 years.
I was scared of him back then.
Yeah, he was pretty scary, and he didn't seem real nice. He didn't seem like a real nice dude.
No, and then you watch A Year and a Half in the Life of Metallica, and you see him goofing around and stuff. You're like, okay, maybe he's a little bit of a goofball. But no, I think my favorite era a James look has to be like a few years. It's like around Death Magnetic, when he was even skinnier than he is now, and his hair was kind of spiky, and he had like his battle vest on all the time, the one that's like fucking covered.
He got really thin around 2011.
Yeah. But anyways, moving on to some of these facts here. James, if you don't know this, he is of English, German, Irish, and Scottish descent. He's been married to his wife, Francesca, since 97. They have three kids, currently lives in Vail, Colorado, which was kind of a news thing in the metal world that he left the Bay Area.
Yeah. Well, if you guys want to go check out the Joe Rogan interview he did, which I can't recommend highly enough. It was such a great interview.
Oh, it's great, yeah.
He talks in depth about why he left the Bay Area. It had a lot to do with sort of liberal attitudes, and he's a big hunter. He wanted to be in the wilderness, and he actually likes sports and shit. Like, he loves snowboarding and skateboarding, and
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah.
He's a real outdoorsy dude.
He definitely is. He has been for a long time, too. But yeah, I mean, he doesn't at any point, like knock the barrier, like, you know, fuck that place. He just, you know. It sounded like it wasn't for him and his family anymore, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he still has a house there, and they still have HQ there. He still is going to be spending a lot of time there. But yeah, I'm sure living in Vail is not bad.
No, I'm sure they have a really nice spot out there.
Yeah. But, you know, going back with Hetfield, I mean, all before this, all before he was married, before Metallica, you know, he grew up, his parents, Cynthia and Virgil, his mom was a light opera singer.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I didn't at first know what a light opera singer was, and I guess what that means is they do shortened operas, like, as opposed to, like, a, I don't know, 45-minute long opera.
Okay.
And then his dad, Virgil, was just a truck driver, but yeah, I grew up around a Christian Science, which, if you guys don't know what that is, specifically to Hetfield's family, it's like they don't believe in any modern medicine, things like that. And I mean, Hetfield's mom died of cancer in 79, I believe. Yeah, 79, when Hetfield's 16. So upbringing like this and what happened to his mom, you know, inspired songs like The God That Failed.
Yeah, and, you know, trying to sort of, from a top-down way, understand James Hetfield, understand what he was writing about, kind of his who he is and how he behaves and all that. This is sort of the first real stuff because, you know, I just read a book that's really good called So Let It Be Written, the new James bio.
That's a new one, right?
Yeah, it's pretty good. You know, a lot of the talks about him was that he was just super quiet, like a real, like, to himself. And he talks in the Behind the Music documentary about how, because they were Christian Scientists, like when they would do health class at school, he would actually have to leave the classroom.
Wow, that's crazy.
And his parents divorced when he was 13, a few years before his mom died. His dad just split, just never came home.
Yeah.
And he's talked before in interviews that, you know, his mom didn't work. So she was doing that light opera stuff, but she had to go get a job, and he sort of attributes her failing health to sort of grief and the shock.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to understand that. And he ended up kind of reuniting with his dad later.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he shows up in the A Year and a Half documentary because his dad passed away in, what was it, 96, 97?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, while they're on tour, on the Load tour. But yeah, it's knowing this background about him and the way his parents raised him, it does help make a lot of sense of, like, everything from his personality to, you know, he talks about a lot that his wife Francesca, like, kind of saved his life and helped him deal with anger issues and all this stuff, because he probably had it. I mean, a lot of that was, I'm sure, stemmed from his upbringing.
Yeah,
you know, and there's a lot of lyrics about it in a lot of songs. Dyer's Eve, you know?
Yeah, Dyer's Eve and Fixer and, of course, The God That Failed that we've already mentioned. And I think, you know, you can trace his drinking to this kind of area in his life.
Oh, yeah,
kind of
for
sure. Kind of a teenager, dad's gone, mom passes away, he's getting into metal. And, you know, everyone says he was always kind of a heavy drinker and that he was real shy, but when he drank, he would come out of his shell and he was real likable and funny.
Yeah.
And then not that long later, Cliff was taken away from him too, you know? So,
yeah, I mean, it's a tough upbringing. It's a, you know, tough situation, not having a father in your life. And then your best friend dies. It's like, you know, things make a lot more sense when you know all these things about James.
Well, even to the point of with Jason leaving, I think he talks about it in some kind of, monster documentary. He says, the only thing I know how to love things is to choke them to death because I don't want them to leave.
Right, right.
And so that all started with this stuff when he was a teenager, you know?
Yeah, totally. But even going back before that, before he was even a teenager, he had two older brothers, and he ended up playing drums and piano by the age of 9, which is super cool. Didn't even start guitar till he was 14 years old. But I believe he has two half-brothers, and one of his older brothers had a drum set, and he would start playing on that. So that's how he learned how to play drums. And thank the good metal gods of the world that James picked up a guitar at age 14. And here we are talking about him right now.
Yeah, and I'm also grateful for those piano lessons too. He's attributed sort of his knack for composition. He attributes that to those piano lessons.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that Metallica would sound a lot different had he only just learned guitar and nothing else.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it probably gave him an appreciation for different styles of music, you know, because a lot of people know his influences, you know, but he cites one of his main ones as a kid was Aerosmith. Other than that, it was like Queen, Led Zeppelin, Sabbath, Misfits, AC/DC, Rush, Motorhead, you can name them all. The list goes on, but so it's cool that he you know, for you know, almost 5 years, he's playing on piano while discovering all these metal bands, and his brain is probably just combining all that stuff to write these interesting parts, which, as we know, after 10 records, he's written some really cool stuff.
Well, I've also seen him say that, you know, he listened to ABBA a lot when he was a kid because of his parents.
Yeah.
And I think ABBA lived where he lived in California.
Isn't like ABBA Swedish?
Yeah, but I think there's some connection with ABBA in the town he was born and raised in.
In Downey?
In Downey, yeah. I don't remember what it is, but...
I don't know. Maybe someone out there who does an ABBA podcast can clarify this for us. You can dance.
Having the time of your life. That's a pretty fucking smoking song, dude.
That's a pretty good song, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
How cool is it that he was such a huge Aerosmith fan, and he would not many years later go on to do shows with them and become friends with them? And
it's got to be such a great feeling. I mean, I know that, like, even on the smaller scale of touring that I've done, getting to go out and open up for a band you look up to and get to know them is an honor, really. You know, you get to finally, like, watch this person that you've watched for your whole life, like, do their craft and be able to tell them, you know, how much you appreciate it and how, you know, great they are, blah, blah, blah. So that would have been really cool for him.
Well, and in many ways, I would submit to you and our listeners, they've eclipsed Aerosmith, you know?
I think so. I mean, they sure as hell are more relevant. I mean, Aerosmith hasn't done an original record in I don't know how long.
Yeah, Aerosmith's fallen on some hard times, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I got to give it up to Steven Tyler, though. That dude, even though he looks kind of like a grandma, like a hippie grandma, that dude can still sing his ass off.
Well, he's great. He's one of the greats.
Yeah, he definitely is one of the greats.
It is a bummer that he's in Nashville making country records, though. I think that's bullshit.
Bad country records.
I think that's a bunch of bull crap.
Yeah. I was on a flight not too long ago coming home from Europe, and Joey Kramer was next to me.
Nice.
And he seemed nice, you know, to his wife and to the flight attendants and stuff.
Oh, he was nice to his wife.
Well, I mean, you never know, man. Maybe he's a total prick
to
her.
That's good.
Well, that's good. He can do that. Good for him. He's got a great marriage then.
Oh, man, I met Joey Kramer on a flight recently. What was he like? He was pretty nice to his wife.
I will say that dude had a backpack and shoes that matched that were covered in like metal studs.
Oh, really?
He looked like it looked like
he's rocking like 1982 thrash metal fashion.
But it kind of looked like, you know, like a 12-year-old girl's backpack, like going to school covered in little studs. It was like, I remember him kind of looking like that for a long time, and he still looks like that. But I mean, whatever. I was sitting next to the drummer, one of the best fucking bands in the world.
Yeah. I saw Brad Whitford at SIR one time because he does that band Whitford St. Holmes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Brad lives in Nashville too, and people don't understand what a fucking amazing guitar player Brad Whitford is. He does not get the love he deserves. He's an amazing guitar player.
Yeah, and he's kind of the Malcolm Young of Aerosmith.
It was real hard for me to not go to him and be like, dude, I'm such a huge fan. What are you guys doing here? What's up?
You remember when you did Honking on Bobo?
Honking on Bobo.
I think that was one of their last records, like a cover, a blues cover
record.
That
was their blues record, yeah. God, what a fucking awful title.
Honking on Bobo.
Remember that? Remember Living on the Edge? That was awesome.
You remember Alicia Silverstone?
God knows I do. All right.
Oh, I definitely do. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No,
you
go
ahead.
No, you go ahead. Stop it.
Reload
you go ahead.
Sucks.
Reload sucks.
One thing that I kind of had a good chuckle at was that one of Hetfield's early bands was called Leather Charm.
Oh my God, it's so bad.
And they had another band called Obsession. That's a cool band name, but Leather Charm, like, because we've seen those early photos of Hetfield and Lars, even the early Metallica photos with Ron McGovern and Dave Mustaine, and there's some like leather there, and they could have gone into glam territory.
Well, like, there's a lot of leather mentioned in Kill 'Em All.
Quite a bit.
I mean, those motherfuckers liked leather.
And as we know, there is no life
until
leather. Yeah.
We're going to kick some ass tonight.
Because we're Metallica.
The lyrics to Reload suck.
I like No Life Till Leather. We're going to kick ass tonight.
Yeah, Leather Charm, awful. Another band he was in, though, pre-Metallica, they actually had a band called Phantom Lord, which is pretty cool.
That's a pretty scary name.
Yeah, I could see that going on and being a band that we all know about, like a Black Sabbath type.
Yeah, Phantom Lord.
Here's an interesting fact I don't know if people know. He co-founded Metallica with Lars Ulrich in October 1981.
Did you guys know that?
That's a deep cut fact right there.
Yeah. That's something we see. You learn something new every day. And I thought I knew a lot about Metallica. But apparently, he answered an ad in the Recycler. And I don't think this has ever been documented anywhere.
No,
I think it just showed up on Wikipedia and Metallica.com today.
Not even James Hetfield knows this fact.
Yeah, it's news to him right now. That's one of those things that obviously everyone who's a Metallica fan, even a casual Metallica fan, probably knows that story. But I mean, what a cool thing to think about that, like, James was just kind of like, I want to play in a band, and opens up the Recycler and sees, like, you know, metal guitar player wanted, and just like goes over with his buddy and meets Lars. Like, his buddy brought him over there, I think, that was mutual friends with them and introduced him. And I mean, that was the seed that was planted, and now we've got our favorite band ever.
Yeah, it's really cool and scary to think about if things had just been a little different, you know. And another interesting part of that story is that, you know, it didn't really go well. Like, Lars said that the cymbal kept falling over, and James was pretty unimpressed with Lars's ability. And then they kind of did that session, became friends or at least acquaintances, and then they kind of split up for a while. And it wasn't until Lars sort of, like, you know, what did he do? He kind of shammed his way into being on Brian Slagle's Metal Massacre compilation.
Yeah, he totally
sort
did.
Of by necessity had to put a band together because he already committed himself to this thing without even having a band.
Yeah. Yeah, so, such a trip. Yeah, if you haven't listened to Lars' episode, we talk about that a lot, how much of a hustler he is, and especially back in those days.
Take a trip with us to Denmark.
Join us. I will be your tour guide. Over there is some snow. Over there, there is snow covering a tennis court.
Dude, I imagine Torben, like, floating on a rug. Like,
oh, for sure he does.
He's on a floating rug, just going off around Denmark telling people facts about shit.
Yeah, just stroking his beard.
That was where Lars played tennis for the first time.
Yeah, he was such a great prodigy back then.
Prodigy.
He plays those loud drums.
He was a prodigy.
So, early in the incarnation of Metallica, we all know about Ron McGovney was playing bass, and then they got Dave Mustaine, and James was not super hip about being the front man. Like, he was pretty shy. He wasn't real confident in his vocals, and for a minute there, they wanted to get an actual singer that wasn't him.
Yeah, John Bush.
Which is really weird. I'm really glad they did. I like John Bush, but I'm really glad that they did not do that, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's one of those what-if moments. I mean, obviously, they would have still been a really cool band, but I don't think they would be even close to what they are, even on by Ride the Lightning.
Because John Bush, he writes stuff that, like, I'm guessing would it have been like a Geezer Butler situation where James is writing all the lyrics, but he's not singing them?
I mean, I doubt it back then. I mean, they're all just trying to figure all this out for the first time. I don't think James at any point in his mind was like, I want him to sing, but you're not writing anything. It's all going to be me, you know? I think, you know, it was they're trying to form this band and figure out who's going to do what and all that stuff, you know, that comes along with that.
You know what's just really fascinating about those early days is that James wasn't playing guitar.
Yeah.
He was just singing, which is just so weird.
It's so weird. I mean, it was weird enough, you know, when they had the pyro accident and John Marshall was filling in for him. He's just standing there with a cast on. It's just like a puzzle piece, man. James has to have a guitar on, especially if it's an Explorer.
Well, here's the deal. When he was doing it in the 90s, when John Marshall was playing, James was in his Black Album Confidence. I mean, he was kind of still prowling the stage. I can't imagine him in 1981 or 82, early 82, being all shy and shit and still not holding a guitar. That must have been pretty cringy to watch.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And we, you know, we love John Bush, you know, he just stuff with Metal Church and obviously the stuff with Anthrax is great. But we are very, very happy that Hetfield decided to step up to the plate and actually be the singer.
So we're in 1982 and we got Mustaine in the band, and it's no surprise to me that him and Hetfield were probably rubbing a lot.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, Mustaine is obviously, you know, it was a notorious alcoholic. And like the way you talked about earlier, when like James would start drinking, he was like, he would open up and be fun and joke around. And then when Mustaine would drink too much, he was just like the devil.
Right. And, you know, I think the problems are even bigger than that, because obviously, as we see retrospectively, Dave Mustaine himself is a front man.
Oh, yeah.
He's gone on to front one of the most influential metal bands of all time. I just don't think that band was big enough for both of them.
I agree. And I mean, not only that, but I mean, with Dave Mustaine's ego, I mean, then like not only bumping up against James, but then you've got Lars in the mix too, who's like,
for sure.
He's kind of like, you know, I don't know, he's basically like almost like they're in the band manager. Like that guy kind of runs the ship, you know?
Right.
And so, I mean, I couldn't imagine years down the road, like that trio right there. Like, I mean, the band would have either, no matter what, he would have gotten kicked out, but either that or it would have gotten so bad that they all just broke up.
Right.
But you know, we got two bands out of it, so.
Yeah, well, the metal gods knew what they were up to. They're wiser than we.
They are.
But it does say a lot about their determination to make it work when they knew they were going to fire him on their way out to Johnny Z's place, and that's the first thing they did when they got there, just fired him, put his ass on a bus back home.
Yeah, 4 days back to California on a bus. Poor dude.
And you know what's interesting to me about that when I think about what must have been going through Johnny Z's head? Because for those of you who don't know, Johnny Z is the dude who got the No Life to Leather demo, brought them out to New York, and basically was their first manager.
Yeah.
And they didn't even have money to get out there, so he wired them $1,500. They come, they're staying at his house, and the first thing they say is, oh, we're firing our guitar player. And he's like, all right, cool. Well, we'll figure it out. We'll, you know, get another guy.
And the thing that kind of sucks even more is that they had already told Kirk Hammett he could be in the band before they even fired Mustaine.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was like something like 10 days before they fired him or something so mean.
I just feel like Johnny Z could have easily been like, look, you guys don't have your shit together. I'm not going to spend any more money on you guys. He could have just told them all to go back home. You know what I mean?
He could have given up on them so fast. But I mean, you know, what he heard, you know, coming out of them recording in California was good enough to give it a shot, you know?
You know what Johnny Z is? We've mentioned it several times on the show. A hero without a cape.
That's right. He definitely is. 100%. Yeah. That era where they fired Mustaine, I love in I believe it's in the Behind the Music documentary. James, you know, you can tell he's really attached to people. It's you know, it's like the way he was with Cliff, the way he was with Jason and stuff. And even in just the couple of years that him and Mustaine were together, you know, he talks about crying when he had to fire him. You know, like.
Yeah,
because I think you know, outside of all the conflict and drinking and fights and stuff, it's like they really cared about each other and were friends, you know.
Well,
and it makes me happy that those two over the years have reconciled and like you know become friends again.
Yeah, and the whole Big Four thing that was largely James's doing. He was the one who kind of reached out,
right?
Because, you know, like, I think, A, under all his shyness and under all his macho shit, I think he's actually a pretty sweet dude.
Yeah, I agree.
And obviously, because, you know, he's got a big heart and all, you know, you can't write the shit he's written without being a pretty deep cat emotionally.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, there's so many songs that they have that, I mean, even taking a subject about your gear getting stolen and writing a heartfelt song about it, Fade to Black. That Nothing Else Matters. I mean, there's so much depth in there, you know, and especially coming from the lyrics that James is writing on Kill 'Em All, you know, we're going to kick some ass, you know, right. And then having all this deep stuff on the next record.
Oh yeah. Oh man. The jump from Kill 'Em All to Ride the Lightning in terms, not only musically, but in terms of just composition and lyrics is stellar. It's like a completely different band to me.
Oh, it is. And I think a lot of that has to do with when we see like people making their album lists and Kill 'Em All's way down there. It's such a different band that I could see why people maybe don't care for that record as much as they do Ride the Lightning.
Well, we talked about it before. There are some fans that are so intense that they got off board with Ride the Lightning. They're just into Kill 'Em All. It's like, I think they're missing out on a lot of good sauce.
What is that weird instrument at the beginning of the record?
You know? If that's their record, that's their record.
Dude, and it's a great fucking metal masterpiece.
Well, it's like the seminal thrash record. It's like the most, you know, right? Like that's what,
yeah,
that's like the beginning of that.
I mean, yeah, that and Puppets. I mean, it's like, If they stopped making records after that, we would still have two classic metal records.
I think Puppets is like the best. It's like the quintessential, flawless, perfect thrash record.
Yes,
but Kill 'Em All, Warts and All, was the first, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's really the sort of starting point of the new wave of British heavy metal mixing with the sort of Bay Area attitude. And
yeah.
The you know, James is downpicking, and that the sound that James was cultivating then, he was so young too. I mean, he was kind of the originator of that shit. Yeah, it's
totally unique. It did not sound like anybody else. Like even if he just Hetfield straps on a Explorer that says more beer, eat fuck on it, and he just starts just hitting the open E string, just going dun, 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 dun. Like you can tell it's him. He has a distinct way he plays, much like when we talked about Lars doing certain things or Lars's backbeat. It's like, you know, it's him. Like it's, you know, like when we talking about To Live Is to Die, like when there wasn't credit on who played that ballad section solo, and you and I were both like, well, no, it's Hetfield. You can totally tell.
Yeah.
And that's what that's another you know thing I love about him is like his guitar playing. He's not like a shredder like Kirk or whatever, but I mean the dude writes really cool parts, and we've mentioned this before. I can't believe some of the rhythm parts that he plays and sings at the same times. Yeah,
they're
like,
unbelievable.
Like on Blackened or Dyer's Eve, it's incredible what he can play and sing at the same time.
Even the groove stuff, like if those of you out there who can play, try to sing Sad But True while playing that riff. It's a mind fuck. It's crazy. And dude, like even and the fast stuff's no joke. Disposable Heroes, even Spit Out the Bone. His right hand is legendary.
Oh, it's so fast. Yeah, and I always love it. And when you see him in the studio, and he talks about doing downstrokes, and he always says he's gonna Ramones it.
Yeah, gonna Ramones it.
Because the Ramones, if you don't know, were known for just playing downstrokes on their guitars as hard as they could. And
well, and going back to Ride the Lightning though. The reason that when all their gear got stolen, I think their gear got stolen at a show in Boston, and you know, famously Anthrax let him borrow gear and stuff.
Yeah.
The reason that he was so like, you know, the story is that he wrote Fade to Black about losing his gear, which I think might be a slight overreaction to want to kill yourself because your gear's stolen. But part of the reason that bummed him out so much is because he was relying. He had that Marshall that was kind of like tricked out.
Right.
And he so closely identified that with his sound, and he was so bummed that he might have lost that, you know?
Yeah.
As a musician and as a guy with certain emotional ties to gear, I understand that.
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, you know, it's all stuff. It's like stuff you can't take with you when you die. But, you know, while you're alive, it's like, you know, you got sentimental value. You know, one of my guitars I've had since I was 17 years old, 16 or 17, and my dad helped me buy. It's like, besides my wife and my animals, that's the first thing I'm running out of the house with when the house is on fire, you know?
Right.
You know, the stuff that you can't, you know, yes, it can be replaced. You can get another guitar or whatever, but it's like you can't replace what that connection is with that instrument or that piece of gear.
Well, we talked about it in our Ride the Lightning episode, but Fleming mentions that, you know, when they got to Sweet Silence in Copenhagen to make Ride the Lightning, they spent so much time, because obviously James's gear was stolen, that he said they spent weeks trying to crack the code on what his sound was. And they said they rented every Marshall amplifier in Copenhagen, you know, to try to figure it out.
All three of them. And then Torben deliver them on his rug.
On his flying rug. It is true. Yeah. I don't think Copenhagen is like a huge mecca for Marshall amplifiers. It's not like they were in London.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? There might have been quite a few of them back then. I guess they're a lot closer to London than we are, so.
Speaking of, let's you want to dip into gear a little bit, talk a little gear?
I do, yeah, because Clint and I both have geeked out over so many Hetfield guitars.
We're going to do a full episode on gear, but I figure since we're doing a James episode, we should talk about it. And I wanted to talk about this amp situation, because he does a really unique thing with his amp. I don't even quite understand it. Maybe you can help me understand it. But his signature sound at that time was kind of coming from, this is starting on the Puppets era, it's when he started using this Boogie. It's a Boogie Mark IIC Plus as a preamp, but he has it slaved into a JCM 800.
Okay.
So he's just using the preamp from the Boogie, I guess, but I don't understand what that means.
I think it's, I mean, I guess you kind of have to maybe equate it to, like, you know, when you are recording an amp in the studio, and then from there you're running it through a preamp and stuff like that. It's just maybe a thing just to kind of manipulate the, I can't even talk right now, manipulate the tone a little more, kind of get a warmer tone out of that preamp. Because, you know, Mesas are pretty squash sounding, very compressed sounding, you know, maybe it kind of opened it up a little bit more. Yeah, I'm not really sure. I've never done anything like that with my setups.
I haven't either. You know, Fleming did a really cool thing. There's a website called Gear Sluts. Are you familiar with Gear Sluts?
Oh, yeah.
It's Gear Sluts with a Z, and it's just a place where music nerds go and talk about gear and shit. Fleming did a full-on breakdown of all of his notes. Can you hear that motorcycle?
Yeah, I can.
I'm in a hotel room in Arizona somewhere. Sorry.
That's all right.
Some goddamn redneck. Oh, it's a vacuum?
It's my, a vacuum.
Is it really a vacuum? My our fiddle player, my friend Mark, is in the hotel room with me.
So, Mark? You heard it here,
is someone
folks.
Knocking Clint, on the door? Is someone knocking on the door again?
Clint can't differentiate between a motorcycle and a vacuum, everybody.
Well, I've got my headphones on. Well, we're probably just going to have to live with the sound. You'll have to edit this little bit out, but...
Yeah, this sound doesn't bother me.
The clean sound, legendary James Clean sound, comes from that Roland JC120, which is like a jazz clean amp.
Yeah, I mean, any gear nerds out there, I mean, like, you know, a very popular, very clean jazz amp was the Roland Jazz Chorus, things like that. They were known to not break up at all, so that's why he had that really clean, kind of compressed clean tone for, like, one, things like that.
I love his clean tone. I really do.
I do, too. I wish Kirk would take a page out of the James Hetfield tone book.
I do, too.
His clean tone is...
You know, what I didn't know until we did one of our episodes, and maybe it may have been the Justice episode, but James would actually, because we know that Kirk never played rhythm, he only did the solos, but James would actually record Kirk's parts with Kirk's tone, like with Kirk's amps and guitars.
Yeah, I think
that was
interesting. I think it was during the load reload sessions where Kirk started playing rhythm parts.
Right. And I think those records are, you know, I think that's a good thing for them. I think those records
I think so too.
Have a lot of dimension that are lacking in the earlier thrashier stuff.
Well, I'd imagine with Hetfield and Lars kind of being the primary songwriters and co-arrangers, you know, they're spending the most time with these riffs, and Hetfield, you know, is probably very attached to these things. So he's going to want to go in there and lay down all the rhythm stuff because it's his, he wrote it. And then, okay, Kirk is just our lead player. Let's just bring him in just to play over this stuff. And then Hetfield would even do all the like harmony stuff.
Yep.
He wrote a lot of the guitar.
Yeah. And it says more about his personality too, his need for control, you know, very much a control freak. He's a perfectionist.
Yeah.
They were mixing, I think we're going to have Michael Wagner on the show who mixed Puppets at some point this year. But I read an interview with Michael Wagner saying that James was at every mixing session, you know, like had a very clear, direct vision for what he wanted his records to sound like.
Man, I can't wait to talk to Michael about that whole era, and especially working with James specifically.
Michael, what are your thoughts about Load and Reload?
You remember when you remember James Hetfield?
Remember when you were mixing Master of Puppets? What do you think about St. Anger's drums?
Do you wish that you could have the St. Anger snare drum sound on Master of Puppets?
When you wish upon a star. At night, do you put your hand on the window? I put my hand on the window, and sometimes I wonder if you're putting your hand on the window, too.
Or
do you ever
maybe,
do that,
like,
Michael?
You look up at the moon and think I'm looking at the moon too?
When you look at...
Wow. I don't know what character that is, but it just happened.
Well, now we've just pretty much guaranteed that Michael's not going to come on the show.
Exactly.
So we're kind of in Puppets era. They're working with Fleming. He's sculpting his tone and the sound. The guitars, he wasn't using a lot of different guitars at that time, right? He was using his V. He actually used a Jackson V during Puppets. And was he playing the Explorers yet?
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, he was playing Explorers on Ride the Lightning.
Okay, cool.
He started with Gibson Explorers, and then, like, in the mid-80s sometime, penned a deal, basically, with ESP. And ESP actually recreated that famous beat-up flying V that looked like
a Electra,
Gibson.
Right?
The Electra, exactly. Yeah, because at a certain point, the neck had broken, like, two or three times, and it was just, like, they needed to retire it and get it off the road. So when he signed up with ESP, they duplicated that thing, like, exactly.
Right. And that was, and those guitars that ended up becoming the Eat Fuck guitar, the More Beer guitar.
Those early Gibsons and then the early years of ESP where he was actually like, or ESP was actually like copying Gibson's Explorers exactly.
Well,
now they're a little different.
Well, I'm looking at this website now. So his first, the So What guitar is a Gibson Explorer. The More Beer guitar, which has a Jägermeister sticker on it, is also a Gibson Explorer. And then his Kill Bon Jovi Jackson V was a white Jackson V. And then it says 87 is when he got his first ESP MX-220, which was the Eat Fuck guitar.
Yeah, okay. That's the model that looked just like the Explorer.
Yeah, and they have a white
headstock and everything, yeah.
And for those of you who don't know what we're saying when we say Explorer style, it's that pointy guitar that James is probably the most famous guitar James is known for.
I would say that, or who else played ones? The dude in Thin Lizzy?
Yeah, yeah. And, The Edge plays Explorers a lot, too.
Yeah, but, that's Hetfield's guitar, everybody.
So then he got another ESP, the So Fucking What guitar. Then he got a black one in 88 that he wrote Fuck 'Em Up on, which looks so bitchin'.
I know, so
ESP
cool.
Made, do you remember this from, I think it's in A Year and a Half in the Life, where ESP made him a double neck 12 string Explorer?
Yeah, it was so they could play Nothing Else Matters live.
Right, that's so crazy.
And it's crazy looking. It's so cool. Yeah, it's a 12 string and a 6 string on one guitar. I remember I think it was in part two of the Year and a Half documentary where it shows him getting it and talking about, we can finally, do Nothing Else Matters.
Yeah. And he has several pretty cool ESPs in that time. He had the one that had it was like the Of Wolf and Man. The inlay was like a wolf turning into a dude.
Yep.
They had one. He had the one Elk Skull one. Remember that one during the load?
Yes. That one's very cool.
Of course, those Ken Lawrence Explorers, which are the wood colored Explorer type, and it's got the sort of dragon inlay all the way up it.
Yeah. Was it not until about the Load era that he started playing like Les Paul style guitars live?
He started playing that Les Paul custom during St. Anger a lot.
Yeah. But they definitely, he played ESP Les Pauls during the Load Reload era.
Yeah. He had an Eclipse. There was in 98, he had an ESP Eclipse called a JH3. It's like basically ESP's Les Paul.
Yeah. And of course, the infamous Iron Cross ESP,
which is my favorite. Well, my favorite is the Iron Cross, the actual Gibson one, but ESP made a signature one.
Right.
And then, of course, he's got these snake bites in this, and the Vulture, which is the V, which are just, God damn it, they've captured my heart. I want them.
The snake bite is so cool. I would even take an LTD one, like the cheaper version of ESP.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to get the cheaper one because the ESP one's super expensive.
Yeah, I mean, we've tried to shout them out before, but if anyone from ESP is listening, holler at your boys.
Another cool guitar he's using, we saw it at on the World Wire Tour, is the acoustic guitar he's using for Fade to Black for The Unforgiven. It's this Line 6 Variax. I'm not a huge fan of this in general, but this guitar is pretty cool because it's he's able to make it sound like a 12 string or a nylon string. It's sort of a digital modeling guitar that they, through the pickup, they're able to model it after whatever they want. You can detune it.
I think totally. I think for what they're doing on this grand scale of how huge this tour is, I think it's smart for them to do something like that. So it's not like worrying about a nylon string guitar and a 12 string guitar and another 6 string, it just gives them options to cater to whatever song he needs it on.
Well, and I can tell you firsthand that they're durable because I watched him kick the shit out of that guitar in St. Louis.
He kicked it over at your show, yeah.
He got frustrated because, and see, this makes sense too, because it was tuned, it was like tuned weird. And when his tech came to check it out, he hit a button. He didn't actually touch any tuning pegs.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then I don't know if his tech was just confused about what key they do it in but whatever. And James kicked it, that motherfucker, over, and I thought, oh my God, that guitar is fucking toast. But the dude came and picked it up, and he had it. I mean, maybe they have duplicates, but he had it out the next show.
Yeah, I'm sure they've got backups for everything. But
what's funny about that is that the tuning room video from the next show, because I guess the tuning room is the first time the boys see each other all day.
Okay.
And one of them goes, oh wow, that was crazy the other night when you kicked that guitar. And James is like, yeah, I wasn't that mad. I'm like, James, you have an anger problem, dude. You were fucking furious. I was there. He's like, I wasn't that mad. It was funny. I'm like, dude, you were fucking mad, dude.
Madly in anger.
He was madly in anger with that guitar.
I'm sure there's still some sort of anger issues there that he has, but not near what they used to be, especially when he was drinking and stuff. So it probably takes a lot more to get him to that place now than it used to.
No, I think so too. I mean, I think he has tools. I think he's 15 years of therapy. He's gotten the tools to deal with his anger.
Right. But, I mean, dude, if you were playing guitar and you were the singer and you're playing in front of 50,000 people and that shit didn't work, you'd be like multiple times it's happened, I'd be like, okay, it's time to kick this shit over.
Well, he made a good joke. He was like, you guys ever seen Spinal Tap? He's like, well, you're watching it again right now.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say about his guitars is he actually has his own custom pickup. So the ESPs he was playing in the 80s had EMG 81 and EMG 60 in the neck and bridge. And yeah. I think in the 90s, maybe a little later than that, he went to EMG and he has his own pickups called the JH Headset.
That's rad. You can bet your ass I'll be putting a set of those in my Snakebite if I get one day.
Snakebites come with them, homie.
They come with them.
They come with them. Problem solved.
Oh, it's two things in one.
Well, that's two things in one now.
If my math is correct, man, tell you what, that's two plus one thing.
Well, I'm not real good at math, but I'll be honest with you, but I believe that's two and two, and you put them together, and that makes two. 2011.
That makes one snake bite, man.
That makes equal one snake bite now.
Don't you go getting snake bit.
You hear what happened to Cletus? Well, he went and got himself snake bit.
He did, man. Tell you what.
What else we got? It's so much to talk about with James. It's almost like we need two episodes on it.
I know. I think we're definitely at some point going to do another episode on James. I just want to because I like talking about him. One thing I always found interesting, and this is another one of those things that is been highly documented, is that James didn't start even taking vocal lessons until the early 90s.
Right, because he blew his voice out during So What?
Yeah, and then he was having problems singing it live, and then he ended up taking vocal lessons and has the infamous cassette tape that he's always warmed up to, and from what I understand, still does to this day.
Right.
It's probably a little control thing there. He has to have that same cassette, otherwise, like, he's gonna have a bad show or something.
I think it's probably that, but I think it's also ritual. You know what I mean? Like, rituals are really important for touring musicians because our life is we're in a different place all the time, and we're just never really those tiny things, no matter what it is, everyone kind of has their own thing. And well, I think for him like that.
Yeah, for sure. And on top of that, when you're a touring musician or a touring tech or whatever, your days are very repetitive. So you kind of get used to those things. So you know, if there's something that you feel like kind of gives you good luck or gets you pumped before a show, you're going to want to repeat it as you do everything else every day. You're playing the same set every day. All the arenas look the same. It's like a very Groundhog Day type job.
You can see him using the tape in the making of footage for Cunning Stunts.
Yeah, and also I think in Some Kind of Monster, he talks about it a little bit.
Which, by the way, Cunning Stunts is my favorite James look. He was just so like thin, and like this hair, and he still had that goat skull necklace, and
yeah, that was cool.
Man, I loved that.
So cool. And I think I made a note that I think him finally getting proper vocal lessons and using this tape all the time to warm up and probably warm down, probably that between that and age has a lot to do with how his voice has changed so much, over the years. And he's singing correctly now, he can't, if you guys are singers out there, like if you sing as hard as Hetfield was doing on like Justice Black Album era stuff, you're going to thrash your vocal cords.
Yeah.
And I think, just him finally getting smart and hip to it, like, oh, I can actually preserve my vocal cords. I mean, who knows if he would have just ignored, what happened with So What and kept singing however he wanted to, would he eventually have done permanent damage to his voice where we don't have a James Hetfield singing anymore?
Well, and I think it scared him because I've only blown my voice out maybe twice, but I have done it. And when you really blow your voice out, you can't sing.
Yeah.
And so, totally. For him to think, oh my God, will I ever be able to sing again? It was probably pretty scary. He's probably like, I need to start taking care of myself.
Yeah, especially when you're like one of the main faces of this giant organization that is employing people, that is your livelihood, that is
for sure, it's
your
a machine.
Whole life. Yeah, absolutely.
I think the vocal lessons paid off too because throughout the 90s, up until Saint Anger, I think that he was just at peak performance. I mean, I even watched them doing I Disappear at like the VMAs or something. And I know you're not super hot on that song, but man, he's just killing it vocally.
Yeah, I know. He definitely is.
S&M, we've talked about the big vocal highlight.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He kills it on that show. Easily one of my number one or number two, like top Metallica performance ever.
Yeah, for sure.
One thing I do want to mention about Hetfield, and we kind of talked about it before, and again, it's everyone knows about this, but this is one thing that I so much it's a huge reason is why I look up to him as a person, as a family man, is to where he is now in life, is him going to rehab during the recording Saint Anger.
Yeah,
that dude, I mean, it took a lot of balls, but that dude put the biggest fucking band in the world on hold for almost a year to do this.
Well,
he spent 7 months in rehab, and another 4 months just like recovering at home and being with his family.
Right.
And to me, that speaks volumes about him as a person, that he can go through all that.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is, everyone's got to hit bottom, and he, you know, whatever was going on, he missed his son's birthday because he was hunting, and his drinking and whatever else was going on. I think he had other problems too, but
yeah,
I think for him, hitting rock bottom was almost losing his family. And
yeah,
you know, I've had similar revelations and, you know, kind of toyed with some of those same dangers. And when you think you're going to lose your family, nothing else matters. No pun intended. Like,
yeah, totally.
That's why he was able to walk away from Metallica.
Yeah, for sure.
And man, you're right, dude. I got nothing but love and respect for that. It scares me. I was really scared at that time because Jason had left. He's in rehab. The clips of the record I was hearing were really strange and weird. But he had to go away and get healthy so he could come back and continue to be the, you know, be the engine of Metallica.
Yeah, and I mean, and fast forward to current, you know, present day, like you and I have talked about this, going to that Detroit show was, I mean, James always seems to be in like really good spirits. He seems happy about life, like stoked to be alive, stoked to be playing music with his best friends.
Right.
And I love that, you know, and this is, you know, him going to rehab back then, this is probably what ultimately affected their tour schedule now, where they only go out for 2 weeks and then go home so they can have family time.
Right. It's a very family oriented machine now.
I love it, man. I love it. And as you know, as Clint and I can attest to, and anybody else listening that tours, you know, going on the road for, you know, months on end, like, can definitely take a toll on relationships.
Absolutely.
And it's great that those dudes, especially Hetfield, I mean, from back then when he went into rehab in 02, just kind of hit it head on and like tackled those demons.
Well, and I think too, in other ways, as we all grow older together, obviously we're not the same age, but I've kind of grown up with these dudes, you know, and they've grown
for
too.
Sure.
And in a lot of ways, not just musically, but in these areas, I'm still learning from him about how to be a father, how to be a husband, how to tour well and be healthy on tour. I'm still learning that shit from these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks, James.
James, I'd like to personally thank you for teaching me how to be a man.
Ooh.
Well, it taught me how to be a man, yeah.
I have taught James so many things over his years on my flying carpet. Man, one of the last little notes here I have that I think is really cool, and I've watched this stuff online, is that if anyone's ever watched the Acoustic for a Cure performances in San Francisco, he co-founded that with Sammy Hagar, which is super cool. Like, it's, I love, you know, seeing guys that are your heroes and you look up to, like, giving back to, whether it's a community, charity, whatever. But these dudes get together and bring a bunch of their famous friends to play songs acoustically and give it back to like a children's hospital in San Francisco.
Yeah, it's very cool. And was that the one where James did that Adele song with his daughter?
Yeah, his daughter's name's Callie. Yeah, they did that together. It was super cool.
And he did Turn the Page with Billy Joe Armstrong. What else did he do?
That one was really cool because Billy Joe came out and they did Turn the Page together, and then they kind of like morphed the song into a Green Day song, and then James backed him up. It was a really cool moment.
I walk these songs at home. I'm the one that says I'm sorry to. That's my favorite lyric from that song.
That one was really good.
That one, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, totally.
They do all kinds of cool like charity type stuff. Did you remember reading about the Metallica tribute band that had all their gear stolen, and Metallica bought all their gear for them, replaced their gear?
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
It's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, can't say enough nice things about the dudes, especially Mr. Hetfield, man. I really would love to meet him again and just. Even if it was 5 seconds, shake his hand and be like, "Man, thank you."
I know. When we thought we might get to meet him on the World Wire Tour, I kind of played it in my head a little bit. And
did you write a speech?
I didn't like write it down like on paper, but I you know, I did kind of come up with some highlight points that I needed to tell him. And
you're like, James, I'd like to say something to you right now. 1 second.
Excuse me.
First of all, I'd like to thank you.
Yeah, it's like
being so James.
There's like play it off music for me, like Oscar play it off music.
Exactly.
Like, get out of here. But it would be some sappy, like, thank you, your music saved my life. You know,
right.
I would have to tell him that more for me than him. Oh, for sure. Because another thing we should talk about briefly before we wrap the show up is, you know, he quit doing meet and greets, and he's, when you met him, he wouldn't do a picture. He's kind of created a lot of boundaries for himself in terms of how he deals with fans, and he got off Instagram and all this, and he said it's because he's really uncomfortable with the rock god thing. He doesn't dig that shit.
Yeah, exactly. It's, well, and also, I think a lot of that is part of was part of him getting sober. It was probably like reeling in that ego and being like, look, you gotta be, because when I thought back at the timeline when I met him, it was definitely post rehab,
right?
But I think it's cool. I mean, it's cool, man. He's just, you know, he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want his ego to get any bigger than it already did over the years.
Well, whatever his reasons are, it's like, I totally respect them. And, you know, in my own small ways out and doing what I'm doing, and I'm sure for you too, I have boundaries with fans, and there's some shit you can, fans are weird, man. Like when I have this Panama hat that I play on stage, and you wouldn't believe the amount of fans who ask me to give them that hat.
Oh, dude, I've had fans over the years ask me to give them anything I'm wearing. And they're just like, oh, can I have your shirt? I'm like, what?
This one woman had her kids with her, and like after the show, we all go down and shake hands and say hi. The artist splits, but the band should go down and say hi.
Yeah.
And she's like, hey, not can I have your hat? Hey, give me your hat.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, no, I'm not going to give you my hat. I want to wear it. And
she goes, like, give me your wallet.
No, she goes, oh, well, will you let my kids sign your hat? And I was like, no. And I actually told her, I said, your requests are unreasonable. Like, I'll sign a thing for you. I'm not going to let your goddamn kid sign my hat. Your little fucking demon child that you made. Sign my hat.
That woman's probably listening to this right now, just cursing her phone or computer right now.
But so if that's on my like minuscule microscopic level, imagine some of the crazy shit James has had to deal with fans.
Oh my gosh, I'm sure. And now the meet and greets are like very supervised with security, and then it's only a certain amount of people. I feel like a lot of the meet and greet stuff, it maybe more has to do with just saving his voice and not sitting there talking to fans for 45 minutes, you know?
Well, what's interesting is that in the 90s at the meet and greets, what I've read and been told from other diehards is that the two dudes that were at every meet and greet were James and Jason, and that Lars and Kirk were nowhere to be found.
Oh, crazy.
And it's interesting to think about now, because now Papa Het's out and Lars has kind of become the meet and greet dude.
Yeah, I mean, the other three dudes are at him all the time. If you follow them on Instagram, they're always posting things, you know, on their Instagram stories about meet and greets every day at the shows.
Well, let's talk about this for a second, because now you can meet James Hetfield, but you got to pay $2,500. What do you think about that?
Yes, you do. I think that's an absurd amount of money. I wouldn't do it. If it was me, if I had the extra, even if I had it, like, what should I do with this $2,500? I'd probably go buy a snake bite instead.
I'm with you, man. I think it's too expensive, and I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it if I had the money.
There's fans out there that are doing it. I'm sure there's fans listening right now that have done this. And I don't know. I love this band so much, but I just couldn't in good conscience like shell out that kind of money, you know? I know that the experience is really cool. You get to meet the entire band. You get to see all this cool stuff. You get early access. Snake Pit, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there's fans out there that's, hey, no question. Like, they got whatever the top package VIP thing is they're putting out there, I'm going to get it.
You know what the bummer is with the arena tour is there's no Snake Pit.
Oh, because it's in the round, right?
It's in the round, so it's basically just four front rows, which is cool. I mean, the set lists of the European arena tour are insane.
Oh, my gosh.
Leper Messiah, Damage Incorporated, Blitzkrieg.
I mean, God damn it,
I can't wait for them to come back. Yeah.
I know.
Well, they're playing Seek and Destroy at the top, and they're playing Moth down, you know, lower, and... Man,
it's still fun to follow what's going on their tour schedule, man. I'm still excited about it. All it does is make me all that more excited when they come back for the U.S. and do either another stadium run or the arena tour.
You know what? I motherfucking agree with you. What do you think about that?
I think that's fucking awesome.
So before we, I have a little trivia for you, by the way. Before we do that, I just wanted to briefly mention James has actually guest appeared on a lot of shit, and
a lot of stuff.
I wanted to just kind of run down it for those of you who want to check it out or maybe didn't know that he did this stuff. I'm going to say it real quick. He did the BGVs on Twist of Cain and Possession on Danzig's first record, but he wasn't credited for it because of contractual reasons.
Yeah,
he did Stone Cold Crazy at the Freddie Mercury tribute, which we all have seen that. That's pretty much standard viewing material because that's on A Year and a Half in the Life, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it's on part two.
It's on disc two, I think. He did BGVs on Manor Ash by Corrosion of Conformity. He played guitar on Eclectic Electric by Primus. Did you know that? That's pretty weird.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I love Primus.
He actually sang Hell Isn't Good, the song Hell Isn't Good, on the South Park movie.
Well, there was rumor for a long time that like it was just somebody that like that Trey Parker did it,
right,
to sound like Hetfield. And then finally, I think he finally talked about it years later, that he was the actual voice for it.
You know who does a pretty good Hetfield is Jim Brewer.
Oh, yeah. He's a mega fan and friend.
He sang on the Government Mule track Driving Rain. He played Don't You Think This Outlaw Bit's Done Got Out of Hand at the Outlaws concert in 2004. Along with Kirk Hammett, he voiced characters in several episodes of Metalocalypse, which I've never seen. Have you seen that?
Yeah, yeah. It's so tough to say. Metalocalypse is really fun to watch, dude. I think you would like it.
He guested on Space Ghost Coast to Coast, again with Kirk, and he appeared on Celebrity Deathmatch, in which he killed Fred Durst. Which is just a wonderful gift to me.
Amazing, amazing.
All right, so we're going to do a little segment we call Metal Up Your Podcast Trivia.
Trivia.
I actually have a jingle for this that we can insert, remember?
Oh, that's right. Ha ha ha.
All right, Ethan, you ready to do some James Hetfield trivia?
I'm ready. I get nervous now that we're doing this on certain
episodes.
Oh,
you should be nervous. Oh, you should be nervous, my friend.
Okay.
The stakes are pretty high.
True.
All right, we're going to do these in the form of true or false. I'm going to make a statement. You tell me if it's true or false. You got five chances to be a Metallica hero.
Oh, I'm nervous.
And if you fuck this up, you're going to let tens and tens of thousands of people down. You're going to let your parents down. You're going to let God down.
And the worst of all, I'm going to let Samim down.
Don't let Samim down. We haven't heard from Samim in a while. Samim, are you okay? Samim?
Samim!
Are you okay,
He's probably crafting his next email. That stuff takes time, man.
Yeah, it takes him months to write an email. All right. James Hetfield trivia with Mr. Ethan Luck. Number one, true or false? James Hetfield is a card-carrying member of the NRA.
Ooh. I want to say false.
Wrong.
Really?
Dude, he's a big guy.
I know he's a big gun guy, but here's the thing. I was kind of taking into account real quick that he's always been like pretty anti, like, using his platform for politics.
That's true.
He goes and hunts in like Russia and like on his own property. So I was kind of thinking, well, maybe he doesn't need one.
No, but you're right. I can see that angle. He doesn't like to be identified with political movements, even though he leans conservative.
And I don't really, you know, research anything an NRA does as far as members. So you got me on that one.
Well, you can bet your ass I'm not a card carrying member of that fucking organization. All right. Number two. True or false, James Hetfield wrote the song Nothing Else Matters to round out the Black Album because it needed a ballad.
False.
That is correct. He actually wrote Nothing Else Matters as a song never intended to be heard by anybody. He wrote it just for himself, let alone a Metallica record. But Lars heard it and Lars said, dude, it's a fucking hit.
Dude.
Record it.
Is he from New York or Boston now?
My impressions.
Fucking kid, it's Lars Ulrich here.
No, get a hot dog and throw it through the garden. I'm Lars Ulrich.
Lars. Dude, you'll meet me in Worcester.
He quit the fucking band. Fuck. All right.
Fuck.
So you've got one wrong and one right. All right. You're okay.
True.
You haven't completely shit the bed. Not yet. Now, number three. True or false, James Hetfield's wife, Francesca, is Puerto Rican.
True.
Wrong. She's from Argentina.
Oh.
That was a tough one.
Dang it.
I made these pretty tough, dude.
Yeah, you did. I know. I thought weird. Okay. Yeah. I thought Puerto Rico, but guess not.
My beloved wife is Puerto Rican.
And it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. I'm so happy that they didn't get crazy amount of damage with the hurricane going through right now.
It's still kind of dicey, but we went to Old San Juan, where my wife has relatives, for my 30th birthday a few years ago, and it was my first time there, man. It was fucking gorgeous. I loved it.
Oh, it's amazing. Me and my wife went down there for Christmas out to Villa Keys.
Oh yeah, I've been to Vieques. We went to Vieques also.
Vieques, yeah, yeah, dude. It's such a great place. If you guys
literally wild been. Horses running around in Vieques.
Yes. Oh yeah.
I was like, goddamn, those are some wild horses.
Yeah, like the first morning we got there, we read about it, and like we walked out to go find breakfast or something, and then just like three horses trotting down the road. We're like, oh, okay.
Did you hop on one and ride it into the heart of darkness?
Of course I did.
Okay. Number four, true or false? The song Inner Sandman was inspired by Kirk Hammett's nightmares as a child.
I'm going to say false.
You are correct. They were inspired by James Hetfield's nightmares.
Yeah.
As well, we know, Kirk Hammett, go ahead.
I just can't imagine James, like, you know, listening to Kirk talk about a nightmare and going, I'm going to write a song about that.
Man, thanks for sharing, Kirk.
Cool, man. Thanks. I'll just take the riff you wrote for this song instead.
Well, we all know what happens when Mr. Kirk Hammett puts the old pen to the paper, and it's the results aren't stellar.
I had this nightmare Frankenstein was surfing with me. And...
Frankenstein.
It was this crazy dream where, like, Dracula and Frankenstein and the mummy and the wolfman were all at my house, and we were having dinner and smoking Cuban cigars. And
then we went out and caught some waves on the ocean, and then wolfman stole my wave.
Then we all just had a good cry.
By the way, I don't think we should ever attempt to do a Kirk Hammett voice again. That was pretty bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of our charm is that we suck at it.
Yeah, it's true.
Here is your last and final question. Let's see if you get it right, Ethan. True or false, James Hetfield was a janitor before joining the rock and roll heavy metal band Metallica.
Ooh. So someone right now is listening and just like going, answer the fucking thing. That is true.
Correct. Way to go.
Whew, I got 3 out of 5.
You got 3 out of 5. All right. You did okay, my friend.
I did all right. The one that I kind of kicking myself for is Hetfield's wife being from Argentina.
Yeah.
Because I was just reading stuff about her today.
Yeah, you blew it, man.
Francesca, I'm so sorry.
And that was Metal Up Your Podcast Trivia. Insert jingle. Well, that was fun, dude. Did we do
it? Yeah, that was a blast. We did it, man.
I think we did it. Man, let's just put a little love letter end cap on this. James Hetfield is one of the most important, inspiring artists that I know of. And I'm so glad he's on the planet.
Me too. I'm
so glad that their last record kicks ass and that he's still exploring shit. And
yeah,
I'm really looking forward to what he's got coming out next. And I hope I can meet him one day and let him know how much he means to me.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I just remember that one time that he was as kind as could be. And yeah, like Clint said, I mean, I really look up to that guy as a musician, as a songwriter, it's just as a human being, you know? Just to reiterate that, I look forward to any new music that those dudes are willing to put out. And let's get a Hetfield solo record one of these days.
Yeah,
come on,
I'm with you, man. I'm with you. I'll sign that goddamn petition.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Here's the deal, guys. Write in metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. Let us know what you think about James. Have you met James? Do you have a story about James? We've gotten a lot of feedback this week about our Reload episode and how much the song in particular Fixer means to people. And
yeah,
how has his music positively affected your life? We want to hear, we love all those stories. We read these emails
please.
At the top of the show. A few other things here at the end. If you haven't, and you're so inclined, head on over to your iTunes and leave us a positive review. It only takes a second. It really helps us out. If you go look up Metallica, not even our podcast, just Metallica in iTunes, our podcast is the first thing that shows up, and it's only because of those reviews.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So thank you to all who have reviewed.
Check out the old Patreon. That's how you're going to get access to our EP. There's other incentives, too, on there that you can check out. It's patreon.com/ Metal Up Your Podcast. We're on Instagram, and we're on Twitter, and we're on Facebook,
we're on all
that
shit.
Stuff. So get involved with us. We chat with you guys every day on the various socials. So.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm trying to do better about getting on the forums. I went on there this morning, answered some questions, and kind of interjected and stuff. So my apologies that I'm not there that much. Clint is a much better person than I am.
Yeah, man. You need to get on the forum train.
I know. Hey, you know it'd be something fun that people could maybe add when they write into us about Mr. James Hetfield? What if we did a top 5 Hetfield riffs?
Okay. That sounds fun. Write in your top 5 Hetfield riffs, and we'll read a few on the show. And
yeah, it'd be kind of fun.
All right. Well, thanks to everyone who listens. We really appreciate you guys.
Yeah, we definitely do.
And we'll see you on
me more than Clint, I think.
Well.
I'm just kidding.
Mr. 3 out of 5?
Oh, face. I can't wait for the next trivia. I'm going to school your ass.
Yeah, you probably will.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for listening.
Yep. Peace.
Adios.
Guess'll be one empty seat when I wrestle at Wembley. I used to tear my shirt, but now you tore my heart.
If you were our advisor, what would you say? Then I would say, delete that.